When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club for the month of December 2016. I'm Katie Waldman, a staff writer here at Slate, and I'm joined today in the DC studio by Jacob Brogan. Jacob is a DC-based writer and editor whom you may know as the host of the podcast Working.
Hello.
And calling in from New York is Gabriel Roth, a Slate senior editor and the editorial director of Slate Plus.
Hi, Katie.
So before we get started, I'd like to throw to Gabe, who has some important information for listeners about Slate Plus.
Thank you guys for having me on the show. I'm super excited to talk about Michael Chabon's Moon Glow, which we will be doing in just a minute. But first, I wanted to let everyone know about Slate Plus, which is Slate's membership program. If you like the work that Slate does, if you enjoy our website and our podcasts, if you found our coverage useful over the election season and you want to help us cover the Trump administration, if you love our cultural coverage or anything else that we do, please consider joining Slate Plus, our membership program. Members help support everything that we do, make our work possible. They also get a bunch of exclusive content and lots of other great features. You can find out everything you need to know by going to slate.com/plus.
You can also find out how badly I did on the Slate news quiz every week.
Well, that sounds very enticing and tempting. Thank you for that, Jacob and Gabriel. As Gabe mentioned, our book this month is the latest novel by Pulitzer Prize winning author Michael Chabon. It's Moonglow, part family memoir, part tall tale, part realist fiction. This is the story of a character known only as My Grandfather, a kind of Jewish superhero whose life mirrors and intersects with the life of the country from World War II through the present. Tongue loosened by painkillers, this man starts unspooling his memories to our narrator, Mike, during his final 10 days. The stories emerge out of order, ranging from his military service as an engineer in Germany during World War II to his twilight romance with his neighbor at an old person's community in Florida. The heart of the book, I think, chronicles the grandfather's relationship with his wife, a passionate, secretive, witchy refugee from France who may or may not be what she seems. Anyway, there's a lot of plot here, as you guys can probably tell from my written down summary here, but we're going to go off script now. And there is a lot going on, and I haven't even mentioned the rockets and the models and the dreams of a moon landing. So I want to know, Gabe, whether you felt overwhelmed, like Chabon was trying to walk too many tight ropes or juggle too many balls at once. Was there anything in this book that you could do without? Or conversely, how do you think he made all of the various narratives in this winding multi-part book hang together?
I didn't feel overwhelmed at all. One of the things that Chabon, I think, is really good at in this book and throughout his work is a kind of big, capacious novel that takes a bunch of themes, maybe from a particular historical period, but also specific cultural tropes and threads, and kind of weaves them together into one big story. He knows what he's doing when he puts together that kind of a big baggy novel that combines a lot of stuff. The problem that he has run into in the past for me is a tendency to then wind up weaving all of those threads together too neatly in a way that often feels contrived. I feel like his most famous book, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, it's a great, great book. I love that book. There's something at the end where he sort of winds it all up with a magic trick that delivers everybody a happy ending that diminishes the book for me. And something similar, I think, happens in Telegraph Avenue, the novel that he wrote before Moonglow. But I think in Moonglow, there's a deftness there's a way in which he manages to make it the combination of these things feel natural and organic that he hasn't quite managed before. And so rather than feeling overwhelmed, I was very moved by it.
I would say that if I can speak to that as well, that while I wasn't overwhelmed by the details that you speak of, I often found myself overwhelmed by the intimate fact of family history. which is for me the weightiest thing here. It's not history that has weight. I mean, we're talking about the Holocaust. We're talking about World War II. We're talking about everything that came after. But it's these little encounters between his grandparents, between Shaban's grandparents, or at least the narrator who bears Shaban's name's grandparents, that I found the most overwhelming at times.
Overwhelming in a good way or bad?
Yeah. I mean, I kept reading, but there were the times when I found myself putting the book down for an hour or two, and it is a very readable, propulsive novel, despite the discontinuous narrative strands that he weaves together. The times when I found myself putting it down were the times when I just needed to kind of bathe in that fact of feeling for a little bit and let those feelings be. Let them settle.
I had a similar experience, actually. The one thing that does feel overwhelming, not in a not in the sense of an artistic fault, but in the sense of an artistic effect, for me, it's the character's pain. It's just the tremendous pain that these people go through over the course of the painful lives. And sometimes that was a lot to read about in a very powerful way.
It's a book about spaceflight to some extent. We hear a lot about rockets. There's a wonderful bit early on where he Shaban describes the tangle of wild black curls that had enacted Medusa feats in zero gravity on an astronaut. We hear a lot about zero gravity, a lot about lessened gravity, but family history just kept pulling me down. And as Gabe says, it, in a good way, it was a literary accomplishment that it affected me in that regard.
I mean, it's interesting that we're talking about zero gravity, like right off the bat, because while I was deeply moved by a lot of what happens in this book, I think I was more delighted and diverted and kind of immersed in pleasure than I was. And I worry that there's now on reflection, because I enjoyed reading the book so much, but like having put it down and thought about it for a while, I'm worried that there is a kind of weightlessness to it and that we are meant to understand that the characters feel pain, but that there aren't a lot of really deep explorations of that pain. And for instance, even when the grandfather is driving around on Halloween night looking for his wife who has suffered an episode of madness and seems to have taken off and may have set a tree on fire, he's looking for her and we don't actually hear what he's thinking or get a sense of his emotions. We know that it must be an upsetting time for him. But instead, we get these kind of glorious Shabanian descriptions of the costumed children walking by in the streetlights. And I just wonder whether you guys had that worry that perhaps this very delightful confection that gestures towards pain doesn't actually do the work of summoning that pain.
I would say, for me at least, this is the criticism that you describe is something that applies much better to almost every other book that Shaban has written than to this one. I feel like this is the moment where he has figured out how to get inside of something. And he does it not through the kind of interior monologue that you're talking about, not by telling us, oh, this is the sound of the grandfather's agony as he searches for his wife who's having a breakdown. But by a kind of heightened dramatization. In the scene that you're talking about, he's looking for his wife. It's Halloween night. He it's dark, and all he sees under the streetlights are little crowds of children in spooky costumes. And the scene takes on, for me at least, a kind of mounting horror, where because he's really worried about her. He doesn't know what she might have done. We know that she's still alive because the book is told in a not entirely chronological way, and so we've seen her subsequent to this, and we've seen her relatively healthy, although clearly a very disturbed and damaged person. But the sort of heightened and grotesque aspects of the sequence, it's another example, for one thing, of Shaban playing with genre tropes, where the grandmother has a night job as a horror hostess, like Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, or someone like that on a local television station. She reads Edgar Allan Poe stories dressed up as a spooky witch on TV.
The Night Witch.
The Night Witch, exactly. And that genre stuff kind of, as so often in Chabon, kind of leeches out of the genre work and into the substance of the world of the book by the contrivance of having the sequence be set on Halloween. But no, I found it very frightening and sort of powerful.
So the book is accessing those emotions, even if the character is not sort of describing them in his own internal monologue. And the book is doing that through the quality of Chabon's art.
Does the book have to access emotions? Our protagonist here, as I think you say in your own review, his grandfather, that is, is a fundamentally stoic character. But that stoicism, that invention of a kind of stolid, stable intensity on his own origins, on our narrator's origins, it is itself a work of fantasy. You described him as a Jewish superhero earlier, which is not an unfamiliar concept for Chabon. But I don't know that the goal here is to show his pain to the extent that there is also certainly more definitely a goal here to show him heroic, powerful, and yet sometimes somehow helpless all the same.
Yeah, I think the reason I'm interested in the various manifestations or not of pain here is because my sense with reading Chabon in general, but especially with this book, is that he is kind of a master sublimator. And where we would normally get a straightforward account of someone's feelings, we get magical realism in Chabon. And so those sort of fantastical scenes, like the sort of fevered passages that Gabe was describing with the children who are suddenly grotesque, all of that is imagination taking the place of emotional revelation or intensity. And so like the weirder it gets, that's our signal as readers that like this is where it's getting really real to the narrator. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it seems like you and I are describing it the same way, except that for me, it really worked in a powerful emotional way, and maybe for you it didn't, and so you're seeing it as a signal rather than a like actual emotionally vivid manifestation.
In many ways, Michael Chabon, I think, is a writer of action. He's fascinated with bodies, especially male bodies, in motion. Throughout the few novels of his I've read, and I think that attention to movement is sometimes more important for him than the attention to emotion. Which doesn't mean that he's not talking about emotion. I point to a bit where the narrator is speaking of his own father, and he writes that his father, mistaking incapacity for a philosophy of life. My father did not often apologize, but when he did, he would first look down at his shoes. That sense in which someone's feelings are encoded in the action is wired deep, into the kind of writing, that Chabon does. And I think the kind of, observation, that he makes of others.
Yeah. And I actually don't want to imply that this did not work on me. It absolutely did. And I think I prefer the kind of masked and transformed, heightened feeling, if it's expressed through fantastic imagery as opposed to like, and then he felt the weight of his sorrow weighing down on his soul. Like, who wants to read that? But it does strike me as interesting because the narrator, at least, says that he's always been all about self-expression. And he even says, I flew the flag of self-expression. I had emerged into adolescence towards the end of the 70s, that great unbuttoning. And he basically says that confession is seen as a transformative act. And that obviously conflicts with the philosophy of life that his grandfather holds. And I wonder if you guys think that the book comes down on one side or the other. Is it better to stay silent? Is it better to talk about these things on your deathbed? And for that matter, is the narrator helping his grandfather by relieving him of these suppressed memories? Or is he taking from him? Is he exploiting him?
I don't know that there's a moral valence. I don't know that the book takes a position on the moral valence of disclosure versus silence. There's a way in which this is a bit like, as in the passage you read, there's a way in which this is an almost stereotypical generational set of traits, right? There's a way in which the grandfather is from the great silent generation that fought and won World War II. And the grandson who, it's made clear is a fictionalized version of Michael Chabon, the novelist, was born at the end of the 60s and is from a generation that wears its feelings on its sleeve. And the book is a celebration of the grandfather, as you said, and of the grandfather's generation and way of life and approach. And it also, the portrait that it paints of that character, it doesn't pull punches and it shows his shortcomings as a person. But I think it's less interested. I think the book is less interested in weighing up the value of these two approaches and more interested in recreating this sort of vanished way of life and vanished approach to being a human being in the world in all of its texture and with all of its challenges and with all of its virtues.
Jacob, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still thinking about the question of that you asked, the question of whether he's taking something from his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is he's adding something to his grandfather. Mm-hmm. The book is thick with what have to be invented details, even in the context, even if we were to believe the basic premise, which is mm-hmm. that in the last 10 days of his life, Michael Chabon's grandfather told him a bunch of stories about his past. If yeah. we accept that premise, and if we look at the way that his grandfather talks when he tells those stories, then it is still impossible that his grandfather told him as much as we find here.
Mm-hmm.
He is adding to his grandfather. He is multiplying his grandfather. He is authoring his own ancestry mm-hmm. at every point. And I would think of that whenever he would describe someone's clothes, you know, the particular weave of the Harris tweed on someone's jacket or yeah. something like this. That Chabonian description is maybe an imposition on his grandfather, maybe an amplification of his grandfather. But either way, I don't think it's an appropriation of that legacy, of that past. And I don't think what we're really looking at, even within the context of what the book offers, is something like a confession by his grandfather. I think instead it's an attempt to imagine his own past, to imagine his own history in a way that invents the self, invents the author in the
right.
process.
And that's the thing. Like, this book strikes me as much about Michael Chabon or his surrogate, his narrator surrogate, as it is about his origins, because they are framed, like they're not named. They are framed as my grandfather, my grandmother, and they basically seem to be participating in this Freudian or Oedipal idea, as I wrote in my review, that the self can really only be known and revealed by revelations about one's mother and one's father and one's ancestry. And so to me, this book is about Michael Chabon and like the idea, just the idea that his characters who he holds up for admiration, it's not like he's saying anything. He has a lot of respect for both of them, but he doesn't name them. And it doesn't bother me because I appreciate art making and I appreciate storytelling, but I also don't think that this is a pure service to his grandfather. Like, I am beautifying your story. I'm embroidering it.
There's a very practical edge to not naming those characters, though, which is that it makes it much harder to tell whether this story is true. When we got to the Night Witch part that Gabe brought up, I found myself excitedly Googling to see if I could figure out whether this program was real, which, of course, it's almost certainly not. And if it is in any way, then he's still added a great deal to it. But it was much harder to find anything but writing about the novel itself.
Yeah.
Because of that abstraction. The refusal to name these characters, that refusal of specificity is maybe ironically a way of maintaining the hoax, the playful hoax, that this is a work of fact and not a fictional story.
there's a thing that Chabon likes to do in essentially in all of his work, which is to think in terms of genre, both in the form of the book and in the substance of the book. So, for instance, Cavalier and Clay is about people who make superhero comics, and it also borrows formal tropes from within superhero comics to tell the story of the people making the superhero comics. That's an obvious example. Or the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is a detective story, straightforwardly uses the techniques of the detective story, or he wrote a novella about Sherlock Holmes. But even in the books that don't seem directly to refer to genre, like The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, his first novel, he's written about looking at Goodbye Columbus by Philip Roth, Philip Roth's first novel, and looking at The Great Gatsby and realizing that they were both the story of a peripheral young man over the course of 3 months of the summer, and finding a little miniature genre and then writing his own entry in that genre. And Moonglow participates in the genre of the family saga or the family memoir, right? There's part of it that is that, like, oh, this is an intergenerational, a multi-generational saga in which we find out how the sins of the grandparents are passed on through the generations. And this is, as you suggest, the sort of, logic of the genre is that I am this way because my mother was this way, because her father was this way, because, and so on through time. But the genre it more directly participates in is the oral genre of family storytelling and lore, right? The things you know about your
deathbed narrative,
and
right?
That's right. And the things you know, the way the things that you know about your ancestors were handed down to you in bits and pieces, in little snatches, maybe while looking at photograph albums, which some of the characters do in this book, except that the photographs are missing. Maybe in the course of an anecdote that your mother told you about her childhood, and that's how you learned something about your grandparents. And the way in which this book is organized, which is chronologically, seems like a mess at first until over the course of the book it begins to cohere in a more conventionally sort of suspenseful and novelistic way. But it mimics that experience of piecing together the stories of your own background over the course of your childhood and your adulthood.
Gabe, you brought up one of my favorite sequences in the book, and one of the ones that is most telling. In her review, Katie wrote that almost any sentence in this novel could be said to encapsulate the whole of the novel in one way or another. But there is one sequence that absolutely encapsulates what I think Chabon himself is doing in the book, which is this one when his mother goes through an old volume of photographs from which the photos have disappeared. And she points to them and she describes what was in that photograph, what she remembers of that thing. It's an act at once of preservation of an already lost thing and of invention, of transformation. And to the extent that the book is doing something similar, I wonder whether it is partially about exposing some of the mechanics of family history, of a genre, which, as you said, Gabe, is one in which the fragment is the primary object of currency. And to the extent that the fragment is always the object of currency, we're always unfolding more than we actually have access to, extracting stories that we've never been told, but only could have ever imagined from the ones that we were told.
Yeah. Well, and also to throw in some more piecemeal rectangles, I guess, playing cards, and especially the deck of tarot cards are really central here. And you see the grandmother kind of doing the same inventive process that you talked about the mother doing. She takes cards and she sort of spins off stories based on these fragmentary or incomplete or kind of archetypal figures and
marks. It's a beautiful
marks.
A beautiful description of his grandmother looking at the card that has a coffin on it and telling a story about Moses' mother using it as a boat that she chases him down the river because she couldn't let him out of the sight. And the storytelling from fragments is an act of love here. Storytelling in the face of absence is an act of desire here. And I think both of those things, that complex interplay of love and desire is central to what Chabon is doing throughout the book as a whole.
You guys were in zero gravity. Gabe, bring us back to Earth.
Well, we've talked a lot so far about the characters and the relationships between the narrator, Michael Chabon character, his mother, her parents, these close and complicated family relationships. But the book also intersects with history in this big way, right? And what feels to me like the fulcrum of the book is something that happened to the grandfather at the very end of the Second World War, when he was involved in what was called Operation Paperclip, which I didn't know, but which I have learned was an actual military, or was an actual project of the Office of, is it? The OSS.
Strategic Services, I believe.
Thank you. The Office of Strategic Services, which is the precursor of our CIA, in which the Americans rushed into Germany after the war to compete with the Russians to snatch up all of the scientists who had been working on the German aerodynamics and rocketry projects and nuclear weapons and all of these military scientists. The most famous of whom, Werner von Braun, is a character who appears near the end of the book. But so the grandfather in this story, in searching for Werner von Braun and the other German military scientists at the end of the war, stumbles upon the town of Nordhausen and the Dora concentration camp, which was where essentially the Nazis enslaved thousands and thousands of people to work on rocketry projects, which they were hoping to use against the Allies in the war. And it's a portrayal of an aspect of the Holocaust that doesn't get talked about as often as the murder of the Jews, for instance, but is in its way just as horrific, and the traumatic impact on the grandfather is very palpable, and it's a very shocking and sort of rupturing moment in the book when these horrible material facts from history kind of intrude on the characters in the book, and the trauma of that discovery for the grandfather winds up, I don't want to say explaining why he is the way he is, but motivating him for much of the rest of his life and the rest of the action in the book.
To the extent that that trauma, as you say, motivates him throughout, part of what it complicates is the sort of subtler romance of this novel, not the grandfather's romance with the grandmother, but rather his own imagined romance.
Yes.
with Werner von Braun.
Yes.
Who he is first obsessed with and has all these fantasies about going to the moon, I think, with. And then he discovers what von Braun has wrought and is just so horrified that decades later in prison, he tries to black the scientist's name out of a book that he's studying, I think.
There's a moment when the Apollo landing on the moon is taking place, and it's in a way the culmination of everything that the grandfather has hoped humanity is going to accomplish in his lifetime, and he refuses to watch it because for him it's been contaminated by Nazism and violence and murder and torture and death. And that idea that even the greatest achievements of humanity are built on the backs of oppression and inhumanity and fascism, it was really powerful for me. Maybe it's this horrible moment that we're at in our own political history, but that felt very palpable and real.
Yeah, the purity of his idealism in the first part of the book was one of the defining things about his character for me, and the poisoning of that idealism was very, very sad and affecting. And I thought that Chabon did a really beautiful job of showing that just in the particular fantasy, like the particular daydream that that the grandfather had before he discovered the town Nordhausen. And at first he, as Jacob mentioned, dreamed about going to the moon with Werner von Braun and discussing the engineering behind that. And then afterwards, he just wanted to escape with his wife and have a two-person settlement on the lunar surface with her tending her garden and them watching Earth sink into night. And it was so sad that the sort of shining achievements of science were now being revised downward. Like, get me out of here.
And yet,
I just want to leave the planet.
Yeah, and yet he doesn't stop there. Chabon doesn't stop there, because by the end of the book, when the grandfather comes across von Braun urinating into a ficus, if I recall correctly.
Such a Shea Bonnier detail, too.
The most Shea Bonnier detail. After that, what is it that when they're talking as von Braun is later looking at the models that the grandfather constructs, these elaborate, beautiful models that the narrator's grandfather constructs, von Braun is fascinated with this model of a moon colony that the grandfather has begun at that point only to construct. And it's his fascination with that moon colony that ends up giving the grandfather a late life's work after the death of his wife in, I think, 1975, where he becomes a sort of model maker for NASA and private collectors, and it's quite profitable for him. So there's some way in which even he is ultimately complicit in von Braun's sins. It's only because of this monstrous, brilliant man that the grandfather is able to survive and thrive late in his life after the death of his wife.
With Werner von Braun and with all the characters, there is kind of this doubleness throughout the book. And I think that we get our first taste of that when the grandfather has his first sexual experience with a hermaphrodite. But it also emerges in the symbolism of the moon, which of course has the dark side. So there's the moon and then the dark side of the moon. And also in the sense that the narrator, Mike, is the product of these two strands of ancestry, the kind of pragmatic grandfather and the dreamy romantic grandmother who is also mad. And that, of course, gets to the duality of the moon, too. You know, one is as an object of scientific inquiry and the other is the age-old symbol of lunacy.
Yes, although it's significant also that the grandfather is not the narrator's grandfather biologically, right? The narrator is descended from the book's hero in all kinds of different ways, but not through his DNA, because the grandfather married the grandmother and adopted the narrator's mother when the mother was a little girl. And I'm about to reveal something from near the end of the book. If anyone hasn't finished reading, this would be a good moment to skip ahead. But the narrator's biological grandfather appears to have been an SS man who raped the grandmother during the war. And so the duality is even more complicated there, right? Because what the narrator has in him biologically is very dark indeed.
And indeed, the history of that historical trauma of Nazism, of the Holocaust, is always in the background for Shea Bonnier, both the character narrator Shea Bonnier here, and I think the author more generally. And you know, if we're going to speak of dualities and the way this book complicates them, it warns us that it's going to do that from the very start with this quotation that it attributes to Werner von Braun. There is no dark side of the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark, and that's something that Shea Bonnier has his grandfather repeat near the end, as if to affirm that was the message all along. That's not attributed to von Braun at that point. Is her name Sally?
Yeah.
The grandfather's lover in the last months of his life. That is to say, if the book is beginning with these kind of binaries, with the dark side of the moon and the light, with the whimsical and the mad and so on, it ends by complicating all of them. Every side contains the trace of the other. And we're always complicit in, among other things, it turns out, the fact of Nazism.
Yeah. And also even just saying that it's all dark is a way of saying it's all mysterious. We'll never actually sort these into two piles anyway. The dark, I think, is, like everything else, not a fixed quantity in this book. It can be very liberating and important.
We're talking about the darkness of this book a lot, and there is a lot of darkness to talk about, but we're maybe scanting the amount of pleasure there is in the book as well.
Yes.
Katie, did you find this a pleasurable book to read?
I was so delighted. Like, I think this is why I'm giving it a hard time with you guys, because when you are in the hands of a novelist this good, it is this kind of uniquely pleasurable experience where, like, all of your suspense dials are, like, dialed at the correct place, and the tension and the release and the beauty of the language and the dramatic irony, like, everything is just optimal. Like, it makes me feel like he built this machine and everything was just optimized. And I mean, I wrote a little bit in the review about the different registers at which he writes perfectly. Like, he can do this very lyrical, beautiful work that's kind of feverish. And then he can do very smart realism. He does very funny tech jargon. I don't know, like, you guys jump in, but how did you feel about the sort of pleasure center targeting aspects of this novel?
At almost every point in this book, every time I really just focused in on a sentence, and you can do it on any page and in almost any paragraph, I found some little gem hiding in a clause, in a choice of a word, a verb alone. He's really just a marvelous, marvelous writer. And it's impossible for me to not take pleasure in that.
Absolutely. I have also felt in the past that kind of virtuosity, which was with him from the very beginning, right? If you've read The Mysteries of Pittsburgh recently, which was his first novel, it has that exact same virtuosity. In that book, it felt like a 22-year-old guy entranced with the possibilities of language and with his own ability and wanting to sort of show off in this very enjoyable way. In his more recent books, I had worried that had kind of hardened into a set of mannerisms. Telegraph Avenue, the book before this, which for me is so colorfully and vividly and overflowing with metaphor and simile and figure of speech and beautiful turns of phrase and observation that it became almost unreadable to me. It was like a dessert with too many different kinds of sugary treat. And in Moonglow, I feel like he's once again kind of harnessed those talents and that linguistic ability, that ability both to make you see things see the things that he describes fresh and vividly, and then also to give it a kind of spin that lets you understand either its context or its meaning or its emotion. He's harnessed that to a story that feels like it means something rather than a story that feels like a frame that's just there for him to display his magnificent sentences on.
And it's also very funny, which I feel like is a humbler type of virtuosity. When you just demonstrate how pitch perfect your dialogue is and how your sort of uncanny description of something just turns very comical. And that, I don't know, I that doesn't feel as kind of self-regarding as other types of performance in a novel.
Yeah. You've been talking a lot, Gabe, about the ways that this book reflects or doesn't or builds on or transforms forces that you've seen in his other novels. I wonder what either of you think about the way that it references novels that are not written by Michael Chabon. I mean, or stories, work by other writers that not by Michael Chabon. In particular, it seems like Gravity's Rainbow, the Thomas Pynchon book, that he talks about at several points looms heavily here, not least of all because it's also a story about World War II and people hunting down rockets and such.
Hands up if you have not read Gravity's Rainbow. I am now raising my hand.
Yeah.
I am also raising my hand.
You know what? So I have to confess, I also could never make it past the first 200 pages of Gravity's Rainbow. And there's a bit here where he's talking about Gravity's Rainbow. And he imagines his grandfather not having read Gravity's Rainbow. And at no point in the book did I identify with his grandfather more than in that moment. But it does, I will say, also talk about Salinger, who I imagine we have all read, if not more recently, then at least more fully.
Yeah, a much more accessible reference than Pynchon is the story for Esme with Love and Squalor is the one that comes up several times here. That's interesting.
The reason that I'm really trying to get at this, though, is not for the specific details that he seems to borrow from these stories and incorporate into his own, much as he says that he has borrowed from throughout his career and incorporated his grandmother's stories into his own, but rather because both of those authors whom he mentions and dwells on are famous recluses. Both Pynchon and Salinger fascinate in part because of the ways that they have stood out of public view. And here we have a book about a narrator and an author exposing and overexposing himself by contrast. What do you make of that? What do you make of this desire to tell and overtell family history and personal history?
That's a great observation. And Pynchon and Salinger in that formulation are akin to the grandfather in the book, right? They're the ones who say only what they want to say and are very comfortable with a lot of silence around the things that they say. And Chabon, maybe the real Chabon, but certainly the Chabon who exists as the narrator of this book, is the garrulous one who wants to put everything down and get it all on the page and tell you everything and not keep anything back. And so it's interesting that he uses those two writers as a kind of counterweight.
Well, as if they're his literary grandfathers, because of course this entire book is about blending, Chabon the writer and Chabon the man. And so he's talking about his forebears, genetically, or I guess through family ties, but also his literary forebears. And just this is somewhat related, not quite on the same theme, but I think that if we're looking for an analog to early Chabon, like the virtuoso who hasn't quite figured out how to harness his skills, I would point you guys towards Nathan Hill, the author of The Nix, who seems very similar to Chabon in his humor and his beautiful sentences and his range and his ambition to write big, sprawling novels that are loosely centered on family. And I think The Nix is actually like a great data point of what this book might have been if Chabon were, you know, 25 years younger.
That sounds right up my alley, and you have made me want to go out and get a copy of The Nix.
I believe that it is Sweet. On Katie's 10 best books of the year.
It is. I thought you were going to say it's on my desk, which it is, but that doesn't help you, Gabe, because you're in New York. Anyway, proceed. Doesn't.
Well, so I know that we're running short on time, but you know, I've been talking about this sort of overexposure of family history, but we're also talking about the ways that you know, his literary grandfathers are sort of the silent ones, the ones that only say as much as they want to, and much as his own grandfather is. And there's one set of details here that comes up over and over again, which cannot possibly have been things that his grandfather said to him in the final 10 days of his life, which is that there is a lot of talk about his grandparents doing it.
Yeah.
In this book, a lot of pretty explicit sexual detail. What did you two make of all of that, of all of this, I assume, necessarily invented detail, detail imposed on them, much as we might impose a story, a backstory on Pynchon or Salinger that his grandfather can't possibly have told him?
I mean, to me, that was just the author is the ringmaster of this grand sweeping show that needs to have its dollop of sex and its dollop of meaning and its war story like component. I don't know. It didn't bother me, though. I think the closer.
Oh, it didn't bother me. Oh, just to
okay.
be clear.
One thing actually that did, I don't know, make me raise my eyebrows were the multiple descriptions of women's chests, like various formidable busts and impressive busts. And I mean, I felt like the grandfather couldn't meet a new female character without making some sort of evaluation of the quality of bust.
It is a very bust ebook.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's generational, right? I wonder if the grandfather's generation was one that had fixated on that part of the anatomy as a turn on. I was struck by the fact that this is the third Chabon novel to feature a sequence of anal sex. There is anal sex in Mysteries of Pittsburgh, and there's anal sex in Telegraph Avenue. And then at the end of this one, Sally Sickle, the grandfather's girlfriend who he meets late in his life, refers to them having performed anal sex the night before. So
that is
that's
a very
one for all you Chabon
compelling data point.
Out there.
Deep cut.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I would say to go back to what you were saying a minute ago, though, Katie. I would and to respond to Jacob's question, I would characterize it the same way, but maybe with a slightly less cynical cast, which is that this isn't like, oh, well, this is a carnival and a carnival has to include sex and a war story and all of these elements. But that part of the project here is to take the grandfather's presumably terse oral narrative and turn it into a like richly observed and visually detailed and sumptuous novel with all of the, you know, mastery of prose technique that Michael Chabon can bring to bear on it. And if you're going to recreate the lives of anyone, but particularly the lives of a married couple, then if you were to leave out the sex, then you can't tell the story of their marriage, right? There's that moment when the grandfather is going to pick up the grandmother after he's been incarcerated and she's been in a mental hospital and he hasn't seen her in I think it's like 18 months. And he's driving to see her, and he's bringing the daughter as well. So the Chabon character's mother, the grandparent's daughter, is sitting next to him in the car. And yet he's about to see his wife for the first time in 18 months, and he can't stop thinking about having sex with her. It's like all that's on his mind, even though he's going to pick her up from a mental hospital. And when he arrives, it's not a sexy scene. It's not the romantic reunion that he imagines. But those, you know, the lust element of a marriage is part of what you have to capture if you're going to do what he's trying to do in this book. Yeah.
To me, the effect of all that sex, of all of that physicality, of all of that lust that he captures is really to convey, to invent, to imagine a kind of intimacy that he only ever glimpsed in pieces, in parts. A part of his family story that he could only ever feel in fragments. He lets us feel with that much more intensity and that much more care.
That's lovely. I think we're probably at the point where we should start wrapping up. So you guys, I'd like to sort of go around and just hear whether you would recommend this book to our readers. Jacob?
I would absolutely recommend this book to our readers. I've just finished it this afternoon, and I've been recommending it to people all week since you asked me to read it. And I'm so glad that I did, and I'm so glad that you did.
Excellent. What about you, Gabe?
I would definitely recommend it to anyone. I love Chabon, and I've read most of his work, as I've probably made clear. And last night I was telling my wife I think this might be his best novel.
Yeah, I'm with you. I highly, highly recommend this book. It's on my list of top 10 books for the year. We didn't even talk about the hero cat, Raymond. He has this third act sort of surprise thing that happens, and I don't want to get too into it, but it was like the most joyous reading experience I've had in a really long time when he reveals his secret power. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me, you guys. This was great.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
The homepage for the Slate Book Review is slate.com/books. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, which helps other people discover the show. Search for Slate Audiobook Club in the iTunes store, and don't forget to leave a comment while you're there. Slate's Audiobook Club is part of the Panoply Network. Find out more about all of our great podcasts at panoply.fm. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. And thanks for the assist, Dan Bloom. Slate's executive producer is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. For Gabriel Roth and Jacob Rogan, I'm Katie Waldman. Thanks for listening.